it was like I brought with me an ability to say, I didn't put myself first in this. That the decision to eradicate, the decision to have a growing ban on local farmers and our business, of which it was the predominant part of our income, cropping income. You know, this is a person that genuinely cares about New Zealand Inc. and the big picture and where New Zealand agriculture is going. And that gave me, I hope, some authenticity and credibility. And it was a courageous thing to do. You know, it wasn't a comfortable space.
Welcome back to Amplifying Us. This is a place where I'll connect you with women who have braved, survived, and have learned to embrace their leadership and the changes that they can impact as a result. Today, we're going to talk to Karen Williams, farmer, director, collaborative leader. And she is a wonderful example of what happens when we find the courage to act in situations which aren't easy. Like so many of us, she followed a pathway from her early career in resource planning to farming with Mick to finding those first leadership platforms in environment sustainability. This led her to adding her voice and leadership to support agriculture find solutions to so many of its challenges. If Karen does something, you can guarantee she commits herself 100%, both personally and professionally. In 2015, she decided to ready herself for her next leadership journey through professional development, not necessarily knowing where that would lead. As it turns out, this preparation literally saved an industry. This is a podcast about courageous leadership, collaboration, and credibility. So let's jump in and hear from Karen. Don't forget to listen right to the end of the podcast, where I'll sum up some of the key messages. Okay, well, welcome to Amplifying Us. And today I'm very excited to have Karen Williams with me. So where are you today, Karen?
I'm at home in Ahirohi, which is Gladstone in the Wairarapa.
So you farm with your husband, Mick. What sort of farming do you do?
Yeah, so we're an arable farm as well as sheep and beef. So we kind of run two different systems. Through autumn, we start putting grass pasture back in and we start trading in lambs and we fatten bulls as well from yearlings or from bull calves. And then through the spring and summer, we grow crops. And so that is where we're, you know, very busy now, just putting those crops in the ground. And that includes both ryegrass seed and red clover seed, and also cereals in the way of barley and wheat. And for barley, it's for feed for animals, but it's also malting barley that goes, its destination is into the beer we drink. And with our wheat, again, feed wheat into a local feed mill for animals and livestock, but also milling wheat, which we can, you know, goes into our breads and et cetera. And we're looking at some more niche markets with our milling wheat as well.
Yeah, and so you've created a little bit of a partnership with the local, wheat millers around some specific products. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and that came out of the alternative cropping strategy, or some of it did, certainly on the face of pea weevil. But so that was looking at, well, what else could we grow? And over the last season, we've grown some durum wheat, which is used in pizza bases and pastas. And when it's processed or milled, it turns into semolina. So it's quite a different product to what flour sort of looks like. Mm. It gives you quite a different texture to work with. So we had really successful trials with that last year and are now just slowly taking it to the next stage, building some relationships with people who make fresh pasta. And we've been working in with a milling company to get the raw product and then been doing some sampling around the Wellington region.
So for a lot of people in New Zealand, they will know you as the pea weevil lady, and we'll get onto that story. But you weren't like a lot of us. You weren't necessarily from a rural background, and you started your career
in resource management. Yeah, yeah. So born and bred in the Wairarapa, but I grew up as a townie, but with a real, you know, like we did then, we all had rallies on the farm, so I used to spend the odd school holidays on lambing beats, etc. Went down to university and studied resource management down there, and then headed back into Wellington to start with, Hutt City Council, and in a policy planning role there, writing different chapters in their district plan and their reserve management plans. And eventually gravitated back to the Wairarapa in a role with Greater Wellington Regional Council. Again, a policy role, but very much working with farmers on farm sustainability, etc.
And is this where you met Mick?
Yes. So, a colleague of mine, actually, she was a graduate who walked in off the street, just finished her degree at Lincoln in resource management, and was after a summer job, and I was able to offer that to her. And her parents lived on the neighbouring farm to where Mick was, and it was a bit of a stage, a bit of a setup really at the pub as an introduction. Rural romances often are.
And would it be fair to say your first sort of, I guess, leadership, sort of very visible leadership, was around that environmental sustainability on farm? You were the local Wairarapa winners of the Balance Farm Environment Award. And there, where did your leadership then go?
Yeah, that's right. So continued working for a local authority for a while, and then had the kids, and the juggle of the real juggle of the farm, a career, and kids, and quite an intense farm at times during harvest and planting. I sort of step back from my policy role with the council. But in 2013, we decided to, Mick and I had, the partnership with the family, the Border family, had ended, and we were under our own steam. And so we thought, well, why don't we enter the Balanced Farm Environment Awards? Because it would be really good to get some feedback on, you know, what's next, what goals, ambitions, you know, you become challenged in that space. Mm. And that's what we did. And so we were very fortunate to be awarded the Supreme Winners title for the Wellington region. And that certainly embarked us, or both of us, but me in particular, on a journey of showcasing sustainable farming alongside having a profitable business and meeting lots of like-minded people. And that really kickstarted change for me.
And when I first met you, you were very much, coming out of your busy life as a mum and looking for how you could add some value into wider agricultural sector in New Zealand. And then a situation occurred. So you readied yourself through leadership development. And I know we had conversations about, I'm not exactly sure where I'm going to go. And I said, don't worry, it'll all unfold. And it did. So tell us what unfolded and why you're known as a pea weevil lady.
Yeah, the pea weevil lady. And lady, and that was a title given to me by my children. 2015 did a escalator and finished in the November of that year. And then about February the following year, I got a phone call about this insect called a pea weevil, and that had been discovered at Masterton Vegetable Seeds Store, which is a seed processing plant in Masterton. And there was this whole sort of, well, what is it and what does it mean? So from there, we MPI were contacted, or biosecurity as it is now, and it was determined it was in fact a pest that had been come in from overseas, and a whole eradication, or no, sorry, a response was kicked off at that time. I got nominated, nominated by Foundation for Arable Research to go on to MPI's governance group to handle the response to that. And so my life went very much from never heard of a pea weevil into daily and all-consuming daily meetings, updates, how are we going to respond, what's the impact on our economy, on our farms, on our local farmers. It was a big adjustment, and hence why I was probably nicknamed the pea weevil lady.
And this is the real cutting edge of leadership, because coming ready or not, it found you. And it it was affecting people's livelihoods, and you were making decisions which were going to affect people's livelihoods. So quite a challenging role. What happened in the end?
Yeah, so there was a number of options considered, and so there's a technical advisory group, and they certainly they feed through into the governance group. And so we assessed a lot of information. We consulted with local farmers, and I guess I was the only representative farmer on that group. But we made a decision based on that information that we had a really good shot at eradication. And if we have that chance, then we should give it our, you know, we should back that. And that's what we did. But for me, as the only Wairarapa person on governance at that time, the only pea grower, I, you know, was effectively supporting a ban that would mean my family, my own farm, my colleagues, neighbours, the whole region, and urban people in their veggie gardens would no longer be able to grow peas, and that was for 2 years, and it was challenging. It was challenging leadership to be the only person and really championing that decision as opposed to reluctantly doing it. To me, it seemed like the right thing to do. We had to give this a shot, and that's what we did.
It's a fantastic story. So tell us a little bit about your pathway, because then you got involved, or around the same time you got involved with Federated Farmers, and right now you're sitting in the vice president seat of Federated Farmers for the whole of New Zealand. So that's a fantastic position in which to influence. And one thing that you have absolutely brought to, you know, visible leadership in New Zealand agri sector is a very specific type of influencing leadership, which, you know, I call very elegant, but it's very collaborative, it's very engaging, and it's really non-combative. So tell us about a little bit about that pathway. What did you want to achieve when you first went into Federated Farmers? We'll start there. And what's your aim?
I think I probably accidentally ended up at Federated Farmers, to be honest. I sort of took, once I stepped back from working at the council and was invested in our farm and the success of our farming business, I was, I guess, going to a lot more meetings that would involve resource management issues affecting our farms and our future and rates rises and all those things that local government mostly have an impact on farming. So ended up turning up to more and more events, and then obviously the Peewee-ville incursion as well, involved in the regional plan process, and had my arable farmer hat on for that and contributing, you know, what would the impact be on an arable farm in this space, because we are readily represented by sheep and beef and dairy, but less so by arable, so sort of slotted into that area. And then I think the policy advisor from our arable industry group said to me, Karen, you're almost really doing this Wairarapa arable feds role. Why don't you just sort of formalise it? So that's kind of what happened. And it was a great opportunity, and I'm really pleased she encouraged me to do that. And then I started going along to the arable industry group meetings, which is a collection of arable farmers from around New Zealand. And the chairperson at that time was Guy Wigley, based from South Canterbury. And Guy was, I have a really soft spot for Guy. He's a lovely man, genuine man, and he really encouraged me to stay involved. And then I guess you could say shoulder tapped me to replace him in that role. And he was, you know, I'll always be very thankful for Guy for encouraging me and having the confidence in me that I could do that. And he introduced me to a lot of people, and he's helped me develop in that role.
Do you think having some visibility around the pea weevil and the success there helped, I guess, get you elected into this position? Because it is an elected position.
Absolutely. And I think I feel like I could it was like I brought with me an ability to say, I didn't put myself first in this, that the decision to eradicate, the decision to take have a growing ban on local farmers, and our business, of which it was the predominant part of our income, cropping income, I hoped meant that, you know, this is a person that genuinely cares about New Zealand Inc. and the big picture and where New Zealand agriculture is going. And that gave me, I hope, some authenticity.
I think it definitely gave you credibility.
Also demonstrated,
Karen,
that I had credibility, and it was a courageous thing to do. You know, it wasn't a comfortable space. Mm. And as part of that governance group, I was made to sign a confidentiality agreement. So I felt really isolated. You know, we're sitting in there, I'm the only farmer represented. I'm trying to influence good decisions. I have no outlet really to discuss this with. It was before Zoom, you know, would you believe? But, you know, I was on a telephone conference. It was very hard to hear what else was going on in the room where everyone else was, and very, very difficult to feel influential. So to have championed what I suppose supported having a regional growing ban, but I was absolutely adamant we would not do that unless we supported our growers. And that was my bottom line with the MPI, and I worked very, very hard with the governance group to develop that support around growers. And we did that with ex gratia payments, more commonly known as compensation. We did that with an alternative cropping strategy, which we sought funding for. And we did that by liaising with seed companies to try and bring alternative crops other than peas up to the Wairarapa. So worked really hard in that space. And so, yeah, to be given the opportunity then to champion the arable industry on a national level was very exciting. And I feel like, you know, obviously the success that we eventually had with the pea weevil helped me open some doors there.
So, Karen, that's a fantastic story of really your particular style of leadership, and I can see it and it's very, very visible, but how would you describe it?
So I enjoy working with people, and I like people to feel good about what they're contributing. And so I have quite a collaborative style. I think it's really important if you pull the team together and make everyone feel valued. I think you will get so much benefit, and the gains will be enormous if you have a team of people that feel valued. They're all on that journey or pathway to making a difference, and that's where the magic happens. It's not when you sit in an ivory tower or you're distanced from the group you're trying to influence. It's really about getting out there and meeting people and talking to them. I personally don't. Regardless of their role, I feel like you should relate to people the same, whether they're a highly important, highly regarded ministerial role, or they're my neighbour that I catch up on the road with when I go for a walk. I bring the same authenticity to that, you know, because they're just as important, and the way their day's going and their outcomes for them and their families, just the same.
I think you've beautifully articulated, really, it's about behaviours and not positions. And, you know, for some people, being visible, having a position is really important, whereas for you, it's all about outcomes. And I think people who know you can absolutely feel that when they're with you. So you do have a really specific outcome that you want to achieve for Federated Farmers, and have been quoted in the media as saying, you want to make farmers proud again. What does that mean to you?
It's an honourable profession. I see how hard our farmers work, and that's by hard I mean in the length of hours they put in. They're out there in all weathers, and they produce food for us. And that was brought to our attention so much during COVID. It was as much as COVID has had some really sad outcomes. And, you know, with people's livelihoods, people's health and well-being, etc., there has been some positives as well. And that for me has been that the primary industries and those that produce food or are part of the supply chain that do that have been recognised for their contribution in that. And I has been a light bulb moment for people when they went back to the supermarket. They went to the supermarkets and the shelves were empty. And it was frightening. And suddenly it all came back to basics again. It's about family and it's about food. And that's, we wanted our family safe and we wanted to make sure that we could feed and provide for them. And that really resonated. And so it's given the primary sector a real opportunity to build upon that again. We're not the evil people we're often portrayed as. It's not about polluting our environment. It's not about treating people badly. Actually, we're proud farmers. We're proud that the production we do is also improves our environment. Our environment is everything to us. We're really proud that we treat our staff well and our neighbours and our stakeholders and all the other people, contractors we work with. Having strong relationships is really important as well. And we need to make a profit. And that's something that often gets overlooked. It's not a bad thing to make a profit. That's enabled us to invest back into our farm. We've spent 20 years planting, riparian planting and covenanting our bush block and investing back into that on our own back. You know, that wasn't with someone funding us. And we were doing it because it's the right thing to do. It looks fantastic. I love where we live, and we love showcasing where we live and saying, you know, this is rural New Zealand. We're proud of producing your food and we will do it sustainably.
So what is your personal view? Because it was interesting listening to our current Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, in the media this week, talking about if she gets elected again, that she will do an investigation into the price of food. On the same day, she was talking about that the only way for New Zealand to become prosperous was to increase the value of their exports and food. Feels like there's a bit of tension there. Do you think it's achievable?
Probably
cheap,
not.
Cheap food and high prices for exports.
Depends where you want to focus, I suppose. Look, our domestic market, we have a strong domestic market, and certainly in the arable industry where we're focused, it primarily goes into the domestic market. We're not making lots of money out of that. The supermarkets are probably take a better margin. But of course, from a social point of view, we want people to be able to afford good food. But there needs to be an ability for us to run a business that can produce good, healthy, nutritious, and affordable food. And so that also has a relationship with the price of land. You know, buying a farm is a massive investment. And most people buy it with borrowed money, I would think. We certainly do. And, you know, we've got debt to the bank. We've got employees to pay. Regulation, the cost of compliance just keeps skyrocketing. Rates go nothing but up. Taxes are the same. The cost of insurance, electricity for our irrigators, you know, these are all fixed costs before we can deliver a product for someone to buy. So there's some commercial realities that we really need to be across. I love the concept of us delivering a highly sustainable product with, you know, zero carbon emissions, only improved and enhanced environment, etc. But we have to realise, and government and our leaders need to realise, that all comes at a cost.
And you're in that beautiful position to be influencing in the role that you have, and no doubt you're going to do that. So you're a mum, so as well as being a business partner on your farm and having a really large leadership role, you're also a mum, and so you have to juggle all of those complexities. In terms of, you know, moving away from your primary role as being a mum and moving into leadership, were there things you had to overcome?
Look, I think you have less time for yourself. You have less time perhaps in your community in a different way. So, you know, I know I don't do the volunteer work at school as much now as I did with my first two children. So I've got three children, 17, 16 and 11. So the younger ones perhaps not seeing quite as much mum quite as actively involved at school. I am still coaching the first 11 hockey team, the primary hockey team. So I give when I can, but I feel like some of the friends I have already recognise that I am busy away doing other things, and I feel like they have my back, that they can step in and do when I'm feeling immensely guilty about it. They're like, no, it's fine. But of course, you know, we still hold that guilt.
Yeah, we absolutely do. And I'll never forget when I moved to town actually and did my research, and I met a friend at the local pool, and she said to me, oh, we'll be really pleased when you move back to the farm and start pulling your weight.
Oh,
and initially I just like looked at her, and it was clumsily said. Yeah. And I said, do you understand what I'm doing? And so I explained, and she went, oh my God, no, I didn't. And it was just hilariously funny, because about 2 months after that, someone had rung me. I think we're at a local function, and somebody said, oh, you know, the dog trials are coming up, and can you do some baking? This girl jumped in and she said, no, like, you can't do some baking. She's busy doing all of this thing, you know, for agricultural woman. And so there is that whole guilt about the roles we used to have when we're really community orientated, when we take our leadership a little bit wider, and we're still giving of ourselves into a much bigger role. But the pullback for farm, family, and community is really strong. What about confidence or inner critic? Because some of those things can play really heavily on us in order for us to get out of our own way. Did you have to overcome any challenges there?
Yeah, certainly at school and even at university, I remember when we had to do a presentation, speech, you know, it was compulsory, and I loathed it, absolutely loathed it. And, you know, that's a university, it was a while ago, but it's still not that. I still have very vivid memories of not enjoying that space. Through this, I have had to, I'm not naturally assertive. I suppose I'm quietly assertive, and there's different styles in that. And I do think who shouts the loudest isn't necessarily the most influential. And, you know, I've seen Dame Margaret Baisley around the Wairarapa all the time. You know, an older woman with so much capability and capacity, and has given to her community over decades. She's small in stature. She doesn't shout, but she has the most amazing influence. She generates or drives the most amazing outcomes for our community. So I think she's a really important role model in that space. I have pushed myself out of my comfort zone. I remember at Escalator when I think it was module one, and you got us to line up in a sort of a spectrum of least assertive to most assertive, and we'd of course done some questions in order to determine that. And I know I was certainly down the least assertive end of the group of 12 of us that were doing it. And I could question whether I'd still put myself there. And look, I've grown a lot in my leadership and my confidence over the last few years, and that is simply because I have push myself to do that. And if you want to achieve things, then you have to push yourself out of your comfort zone. And you can sit and you can whinge, or you can mentally beat yourself up or blame someone else because it hasn't gone your way, or you can change it. And that is the path I have chosen to take. Getting into politics in Federated Farmers, you know, I'm the only woman on the board, and there's very few, there's only a couple in our whole national council. There's only one in the arable council. So we're still a bit thin on the ground. I really want to change that. I want to bring through more women into those leadership roles. But I'm as uncomfortable as it is sometimes, at being that only voice, I'll keep pushing and I will champion other women to come through.
So what I'm hearing you say is you're getting more comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's a good summary. Yeah.
Because I think, you know, into challenging situations where there are high stakes and there are personalities and different agendas and different ways that people will communicate their agendas, it is always going to be uncomfortable. But I think as we grow in our leadership, we get more used to it. So we get more comfortable with being uncomfortable and knowing it will pass and kind of really stepping into bringing that authenticness there. And we've definitely seen your style of leadership, which is very collaborative, which brings people on along in the journey. So I'm going to end the podcast with a question I ask everybody. It's 15 years from now, and we're on the right pathway in terms of nailing sustainability, you know, food insecurity, all of the big meaty issues that we have to actually tackle in the next few years. What do we need to do now so we're getting it right in 15 years' time?
Interestingly, we've been talking about communication and collaboration. I mean, that won't change. We need to be connecting better. There's still too many silos, and that's within the agri sector itself, but also within government. I mean, sometimes we'll talk to one particular ministry and then you'll talk to another who has an influence, a different ministry, and they're not connected at all either. So I think, you know, we're a small country. We're generally well regarded for our agility and our ability to tack quickly. I think we need to certainly make that more effective. So, yeah, let's break down the walls. Let's talk to each other. Let's build trust. Because, as I said to her, my collaborative style, that's where the magic happens. No one person has all the answers. I certainly don't. I'm not aware of all the problems either. And until you talk to everyone and gather those problems together and then start to, you know, when you're in a room and it starts sparking because you know someone's on your wavelength and they get it and they get you, and then suddenly you start to develop these amazing possibilities to wicked problems. And that's what we need. And I would like to see more trust develop in our sector so that we get that. And that would also lead to more collaboration, more efficiency as well. And, you know, farmers, we feel like we're shelving out money all the time for different things. So let's put out the outcomes for our farmers first, and farmers and growers, and then see what comes from that.
Well, Karen, thank you so much. Thank you so much for getting out of your comfort zone and showing us your leadership and showing a lot of people the way on how to actually get a phenomenal result when you're actually faced with a lot of challenges. I look forward to seeing where you go in the future, but thank you for bringing your credibility and your particular style of leadership to the agri sector in New Zealand.
Thank you, Lindy. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, and thank you for, going right back, developing Every Woman's Development Trust and giving me the opportunity to join Escalator and, begin on this journey of who knows where it'll take me.
There's a saying that success occurs when preparedness meets opportunity. And Karen demonstrates this. So many women ask me, if I do this program, this course, where will it lead? And no one can answer that. But what I've seen is when we ready ourselves in building the skills of leadership, spending time finding what stirs our heart and gaining confidence, this leads to outcomes we never anticipated. What particularly struck me in Karen's story, when she was talking about the hard decisions she was making for her community of growers, including her own business, she said something really powerful. She said, "I didn't put myself first." It speaks of doing the right thing at the right time, regardless of the personal discomfort and cost. Attending to the needs of the people you're there to serve And when we see this in people, it builds trust and credibility. Wherever you're listening in the world, thanks for tuning in, for your curiosity. Until next time, hare rā.